Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Every once in a while, when I interview someone, I am absolutely gobsmacked by the experience. I walk away from my conversation with this human being, with my world utterly transformed. And I believe a little bit more in the magic in the world. I believe a little bit more in the magic in other human beings. And that's exactly what happened when I had my conversation with Salem Green. Now, she is the inaugural poet laureate for Birmingham, Alabama, but she's also a storyteller and healer. She's a Kellogg Foundation racial healing facilitator, as well as an Alabama Humanities Foundation Road Scholar. I could tell you so much about Salem, like how she holds an English degree from the University of Montevallo and a master's in early childhood education from the University of North Dakota. But you know what? I'm just going to let her do it because, quite honestly, this was one of those interviews where I just basked in her glow, in her words, in her presence. And all I thought the entire time was, preach. And so Salem, she preaches in the very best way, with generosity of spirit and with grace, in her poetry, in her presence in the world, in the work that she does in the world, but especially in this conversation with me.
And I looked inside of the Wallace House. Now, the Wallace House is swept clean. So it's not an antebellum home or a space that you usually tour, that we tour, where you see these fancy curtains and these all these things. It's swept clean by meaning it's just wallpaper that's been stripped and been there for hundreds and hundreds of years and just all this thing. But anyway, I looked up into the windows of this tall white building while I'm there finishing some writing and getting inspiration. And I saw this glimpse of this lady in a yellow apron.
The first question I ask everybody is, how do you self-describe? If you had to appear on a stage, which you have, or you know, introduce yourself to a small group of people, how would you do that?
Start off with the really great questions. Oh my goodness. I am a very, very joyful, sometimes not always as joyful as I want to be joyful, Southern Black woman who lives in urban Birmingham, Alabama, who's originally from rural America, where my heart bleeds and always will be, in a small town called Greensboro, Alabama. And I am an accidental poet. I did not ever understand or know that there was such a world where I would be a poet, but I am a poet, an accidental poet from rural Alabama who just loves the whole idea of writing and words and the healing power of words.
Truly. I mean, when I was telling you, I was refreshing myself on who you are, and your work is so expansive. And one of the things I love that you brought up, you're an accidental poet. I thought to myself, one of your taglines could be a t-shirt or something, become an accidental poet, because I think a lot of people are walking around this world and they want to express things or feelings, and they might think about poetry and get intimidated. But first of all, putting yourself out there in any shape, any form is very brave. It's very brave because it's very scary to put yourself out there. But poetry is this whole other beast in my mind. And I just think to myself, oh my gosh, how did you become so brave to do that?
Oh my goodness. I love the whole idea of become an accidental poet. I think in 2025, that's the tagline for the world. It's a global tagline. It's, if you're going to ever express yourself, just become an accidental poet. Do not like try to worry about, you know, all of the things that you think you don't know. Yeah. But for me, I don't even, you know, you think about how did this happen to express myself? I'm one of those people who I would self, you know, identify as an introvert, but I don't hold that label close and dear. I don't even know what it means, except for that I love solitude with my little dog, Gigi. And all my life, I've loved solitude. So I've never really been comfortable in like social settings with folks, but I've always known that I could like speak in front of like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people or just big crowds of people, and then leave the stage and go back to my solitude and be fine. Where most people have this stage fright, I don't have stage fright. I have sit with other people fright, you know, and sit in a dinner party fright, you know, what have you, you know, networking fright. But the stage fright, I don't necessarily have. So I think there was just this innate thing that I always knew that I had a voice that could speak very well as far as articulation and projection and just having that gift. And that's has kind of gotten me to be able to express myself, you know, and I think sometimes it has been because of loneliness and having to sit inside of myself and bury myself into reading and bury myself into sitting under oak trees and really becoming comfortable with my inner world. Yeah.
Thank you for that. I do want to just be a little shallow right now and just tell you that, you know, here I am looking over your website, which is just exquisite. And by the way, you are gorgeous.
Let's okay, thank you. Okay.
At your headshots and the other images that you have on your website. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I got a little intimidated, to be honest. I was like, I'm a little intimidated, but not just because of how beautiful you are, clearly inside and out. Also because of some of the work, maybe probably all of the work that you've done in the past. And what particularly caught me is this new book that this gorgeous cover, the other Revival Poems and Reckonings. And I just was gobsmacked. And on your website, it says it's a collection of poems unearthed from the soil of the Wallace Plantation. This deeply personal and historically rooted work, you interviewed descendants of enslaved people and descendants of their slave owners. And I just want to ask, how did this, I don't know, because this book to me is a revelation. How did this revelation come to your heart?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all of that. Yes, I think it came. I'm living a life on assignment, you know, oftentimes like, what is my purpose and all this kind of thing. And I think I'm from assignment to assignment to assignment. Now, especially since I'm menopausal and in that light, I'm like, I'm going to lose my, you know, I'm like, I don't care. Forget purpose and calling. Let's just do some assignments. Okay. This is where I'm going. You know, I believe in God. This is okay. Push me through. And so, of course, there's nowhere on my Black woman from the South card that says I want to go to a plantation house and be a poet. I mean, all that sounds really wackadoodle, right? It's like, who, like, this is not like necessarily something that's a career driven moment, you know, or could even be something you could think of. But I really had an opportunity to, in a lot of my work, community work. I'm a former racial healer for the Kellogg Foundation. So I've done lots of racial healing and work towards reconciliation, or whatever we might call it today. And that work has kind of just driven me into spaces such as the former Wallace House Plantation, where I was a poet in residence for many years, where I sat and I just have done beautiful storytelling workshops and storytelling experiences, particularly with Black descendants who still live in that particular part of America. And as a storyteller and a poet in residence, it was just so beautiful, but it also came to my knowledge and my thought, how do we capture this oral history? You know, oral history is so important in America, particularly for my elders and our aging population. And we know, and we have social media, we have all these other beautiful digitized ways of creating memories. But when you sit on a, let's just be cliche, on a front porch in the South, and it's really what we were doing, telling stories about their lives, I thought, how can we capture this in a way in which when we read it, we really feel the rhythmic, poetic soul of the folks whose lives have been touched by this? So I didn't think so much about, I think, the glorification of a plantation. Let's decenter that. Let's decenter all of that. Really didn't think about the guilt or the shame of the white slave owners or the fear of them being a part of it. I thought about stories that were important to America, important to the canvas of people who live in America. And how can we get this story out here? We have living descendants who want to talk about their families, want to talk about their heritage. And as a poet, I was like, let me sit, let me listen well, and let me see if we can collaborate on some poems. Poetry, like you said, can be overwhelming, but also we can't disagree with poetry. You know, we can't disagree with the verse and the stanzas. Like we can read an op-ed or we can read a nonfiction book and we could say, ah, you know, but when we read a poem, I think it drives us into the whole idea of that this is imagination and this is real. This is somebody else's story that's been imagined through the whole portal of spirit. So long answer to say, yeah, I'm this spooky creative who thought, like, let's just do this. Let's see what happens. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have to say long, but satisfying. And I was just thinking to myself, you and the medicine and the beauty that you're creating is exactly what I needed today. Mm-hmm. Because I think, I don't know, obviously, I'm sure you've been noticing that the world is a little polarized and things are, yes, stressful, heartbreaking, heart-wrenching. And I think it is good and it's necessary to interact and meet with people who can be touch points in our lives that remind us that magic and beauty, transformation, catharsis, alchemical work are real and they're doing it every day and how they move throughout the world. And that's what you're doing for me right now, just to let you know. Not only is your work a revelation, but you are a revelation because you are showing up. I appreciated you're saying there are these appointments that you're showing up for and, you know, you recognize them, but not only that, I think, you know, you could deny them. You could say, no, I'm not going to accept the invitation because each one is an invitation. But you seem, you're like ready to accept the invitation. Am I right about that?
Oh my gosh. I love, yeah, yeah. Now, of course, there should be some no's somewhere in the world, in my world. But yes, but when you're invited, like the privilege of being invited into the story of someone else, mm-hmm. someone else's story, the privilege and the honor to sit with someone and listen to them, not just talk about their life, but to express how important it is to know about the wholeness of what fulfills them and the people who came before them and the people who they are now as a result of that. Like that is like the alchemy of medicine. That's the way that, you know, poetry is medicine, but I believe that it is so important when you're invited in to someone's life to pay attention, to pay attention. I talk a whole lot in my work about we want to have the capacity, we want to have the bandwidth, but at the same time, there's an energy or a spirit, I believe, that drives the work that I do. When I did this book, The Other Revival, and really sitting and really thinking about, like, am I the right one to help tell these stories? Am I the right one who should be writing this book? All those things. And as I sat there and I really thought, what would my ancestors want me to do? I come from Black descent, enslavement. You know, I understand, you know, what this really means to be in America and have this heritage of being stolen and having this heritage of a family being stolen. So what it means for me to go in and sit with folks and listen to those stories is something much more powerful. So I believe that it was a divine assignment. And it happened. And I, and also being welcomed in. It's like, you're welcome, you know, these Black descendants and descendants of the enslaved that welcomed me in and say, these are scary, hard, challenging stories. But also, Kirsten, beautiful. Like, there's more to people and more to us than the damage that has been done.
Yes. Yes. And I think one of the things I'm thinking about is, you know, I really think about beauty a lot. And what does beauty look like? And what does it mean to bring beauty into the world? What does it look like? Because I, you know, as a kid, I loved to make mud pies.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was something about the texture of the mud. There was something about the smell of it. It was just very satisfying. I didn't have a lot of toys. So the mud pies were like great. And there was something deeply satisfying about kind of taking something that people would walk over, that people wouldn't even notice, that maybe had been created because it had rained the night before, that hadn't existed the day before, and working with it to create something new, whether it was a pie or some sort of weird shaped house or whatever it was. But creating beauty out of something that other people dismiss. And I think about what's happening in the US right now and the polarization. And I think of things in images. That's how things come to me. And so I think about words and how important words are and how they can create our reality and how it's inclement upon each and every one of us to use words to create beauty for others, to create justice for others, to create equality for others. But some people didn't get that memo.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's like the beauty is kind of providing this bulwark or this kind of moat, or this, we're pushing back. We're creating as much beauty as we can, as quickly as we can, and including as many people as we can to push back against this, what's at times seems like an overwhelming tide of fear and recrimination and creating a narrative that doesn't even seem, well, it's malign, you know? And so I think about you and the work that you're doing. I think about the work so many of my friends are doing, and it can be exhausting. So how do you replenish yourself? How do you, you know, drink from the waters of inspiration and make sure your energy levels? Because look, aside from what's going on in the US right now, also this book, The Other Revival. Yeah. I mean, challenging, heartbreaking stories, but with beauty also. I can't even imagine what it was like to receive those stories. So how did you take care of yourself, replenish your soul, your spirit?
Yeah. Thank you for that, because that's so much truth. Like, we have to remind ourselves. And I will say it's been a real challenge for me to do that. To remind myself of the beauty and to like make a choice, because it's a choice to see the beauty. It's a choice to, especially as an artist, to like decide that I'm going to push myself more into the joy and the love while also focusing on the justice and the responsibility of what I have as an artist. So as I was writing this book, and it's maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it takes a while to finish a book. I got really, really ill. And I said to myself, I was like, okay, the plantation trying to kill me, y'all. This plantation's trying to kill me, literally, you know. And I know I'm being sarcastic now, but I was like, okay, because I think the whole idea of a Black body such as mine, a Black woman body such as mine, a Black Southern body woman as mine, going back into this space and this existence in this space, there's something that really happens in our DNA and chemically that happens, that we go back into memory, which memory is very healing, but memory also can begin to allow us to heal in spaces that we didn't know that we were still breaking, our hearts were still breaking in. And this breaks my heart when I think about the polarization in America, but also it just continues to break my heart when I think about what's happened to, during enslavement, what happened to my ancestors and what continues to happen in America. So my body felt that, and I'm a very sensitive, fragile being. I love ease and my body felt that. And so I got really, really ill and I did not pay attention and know that until it happened. And when I say I had a couple two blood transfusions at the time, very, very anemic. Spirit was saying this place is sucking the blood out of somebody or something. And I always feel like I felt like I had one foot in the grave and one foot on the earth and that land and that soil. And everyone's like, "You're always so damn poetic." I'm saying, "No, I'm not poetic. I'm just saying, I'm dying over here." And I had to step back after writing this book to really pay attention to what happens to the body when it's breaking or when the heart's breaking. But I also had to step back to be in some gratitude to a higher being to trust me with that message. And that message was to replenish myself, but that message also was saying, imagine what these kinds of spaces and these places of, reclamation are doing to people who aren't even paying attention and don't have that. So I replenished myself first by acknowledging a chemical reaction that happens when we enter into these spaces or conversations around these types of topics. A lot of people can't do that, aren't ready, and body and chemical just won't let them do that. But those of us who are closer to the healing and closer to the medicine, I think are prepared for that. So for me, I acknowledge that. And the way I continue to replenish myself as a result of that is going back into my personal well of solitude, personal well of imagination. And I'll end with this. On the land, there was, when I was doing this book, The Other Revival, and it was like clearly on former plantation land, hundreds and hundreds of acres of plantation land, which is beautiful. There have been horrible incidents that have happened on beautiful land, which is our earth. It's beautiful, And as I was starting to feel better and replenishing myself, doing the things we're supposed to do, drink water, eat healthy, go to the doctor, take my medicine, all the things that we sometimes don't do as artists and high achievers. I went to the end of the land, kind of like in this little pocket of space that had this beautiful grass and all of these dandelions are growing. And as I looked in the soil, I saw all these different like little pieces of pottery that were dug deep, 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 deep in the soil. So I'm like, they looked like someone has taken out pottery and just smashed it. And over the 20 years, it has just gotten so deep in the ground. And so if it hasn't rained and the soil is dry, you see all of these blue and red and yellow little pieces of ceramics just coming up in this land, this plantation land in the middle of rural America in Alabama. What is this? So I'm like, hey, where is all of this? Like, these shiny ceramic like gems coming from, and no one could answer me. No one had an answer to like, I guess someone, dropped pottery. I guess someone broke some glass out here. I'm like, but it's now unearthing itself. And I'm like, oh, okay. It's unearthing itself for me to see how beauty persists and continues to exist. And that replenished me enough to continue to remind myself that even in my body, in my heart, beauty continues to persist and exist. It's like those little shards of pottery that are now like unearthing themselves at the right time underneath each other, shining and beautiful over the years. And so I think we replenish with ourselves when we pay attention, when we begin to look at things through the eyes of softness and tenderness and nurturing the world.
Thank you for that. I was listening to you and thinking about, you know, the land at that plantation, because, you know, among many other, I don't know, you could say subjects, entities, whatever, the land was witness to what happened there. And not only do I know that there was great suffering and heartbreak and sadness and sorrow from the human beings that lived on that land, but I believe the land's heart was breaking as well. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a firm believer in trees, bushes, the land co-creating with us, but also having to bear witness to some things that are beyond what we can comprehend. And I was thinking about dirt and mud and humus and how the land is constantly breaking down and regenerating and, you know, providing, well, now we know, communication pathways for mycelial networks, and that trees are talking to each other, and just what they, you know, the land, the trees, all of these live beings were saying to each other while the plantation was in use. And I think about, you know, the land is always regenerating. So I suspect that it has always been eternally rebirthing itself from the heartbreak and horrors that happened. But I was wondering if you thought, you know, human beings can come then now like you and be in the presence of the land, be in the presence of the plantation, be in the presence of all these stories, you know, that were created over time on the plantation. We have the responsibility to heal those stories, to, I mean, I don't want to say become hummus because that sounds a little dark, but, you know, we have the responsibility to step into these places and become part of the healing, the regeneration of the space, of the energy, of the stories that have happened there, while also acknowledging the stories. Would you agree with that?
100%. I think that is our responsibility. When we think, everyone thinks, what can I do? What can I do when there's polarization, when there's discussions of challenges, and what can I do organizing and activism? And it, sometimes it's, okay, what you can first do is acknowledge these things, but also your energy and your spirit, taking it to a place or a space, you know, taking that energy and that spirit to, and co-creating with the land, everything from what I have people to do. And sometimes when I do rituals in different spaces, like Wallace House with other spaces, I always ask someone to bring something of beauty to offer in this space. You know, even if that is just you, you know, if that's whatever, and pray over this space or chant over this space or walk over this space or be in this space. I totally think we are co-creators, regenerating a planet so that the planet can continue to hold space for ourselves and humanity. Yes.
Thank you for adding that last part about the planet continuing to hold space for us, because sometimes, some days, I kind of imagine myself as a planet and I'm like, I just want to shrug my shoulders today and be like, this experiment is not going well.
Shift some people off the earth. Like, no, that's not. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to go to this piece of you as, I think, the inaugural Poet Laureate of Birmingham.
Yes.
Did you expect this? How did it feel, how, you know, at the beginning, but how does it feel now?
Like I said earlier, like an accidental poet, you know, now I know, but my early years of my former life, I was a master's in early childhood education. So I spent a lot of time working with little children. I am from a rural part of Alabama in America where growing up, I wasn't introduced to poetry or introduced to literature in an expansive way, or even careers, or even that poets did this kind of thing. So when you say poet laureate, I probably didn't hear that there was a such thing as a poet laureate until, I don't know, my late 30s and 40s, but I started this work in my 40s. So I started really late in life. And I was like, I didn't even know there was a thing. And so I'm like, okay, there's a thing, and this is really prestigious, I think, you know, but it seems very like, you know, I don't know. I don't want to be a part of it. But yeah, so I've been doing this community work, bringing poetry in a space of storytelling. I have a literary healing arts business where I use poetry and storytelling as a tool to help people to heal their lives through writing and using their voices to heal their own lives. So I've been doing that in community, like little workshops and trainings and that kind of thing. So when this opportunity came, someone's like, you should apply. And it's the first time that we have it here in Birmingham, Alabama. And I know other cities and states and regions many, many years, but at Birmingham, our state has poet laureates, but not our cities. And I was like, I don't know about applying. I don't know. I don't know if I really want the pressure of all of this. Birmingham, what people might not know, Birmingham is one of the largest cities in Alabama. We have maybe 200,000 people. So it's very urban. And it's one of those spaces where it's just an urban space. But anyway, I applied probably about 10 minutes before the application closed. Which also I'll have to admit is probably not that odd for my life. One of the things I do in the world, I'm like, okay, I guess I should get around to this. And I was like, I don't know. And I finally just hit the submit button. I was like, I know this is not a good application, you know? And there are great poets in this city. More people are applying. But I just hit the submit button at the very last minute. I just said, okay, I'll do this thing. And then, you know, we had many interviews and applications, kind of formal, and finally, you know, got it. And I was like, I don't think it's supposed to be me, but here's another assignment. So yeah, when I say accidental poet, yeah, accidentally like submitting something at the last minute. You know, I tell people just hit the submit button, just turn it in. Yeah.
Well, and actually hit the submit button on your own life, even if you're an artist, you know, like show up, because we need people to show up. There are so many people that just thinking about a dear friend who I do love desperately, but she has a lot of privilege and she would admit that. But just yesterday, she's like, I'm not getting involved with anything that's going on. She's stepping back from everything. And I thought to myself, okay, that's not what we need right now. Those are not the people. And by the way, you know, are you aware of the privilege that you had in choosing not to engage? Because that is a massive amount of privilege. And I thought, I'm going to need to take some time off from our friendship, because I'm just one of those people. I'm like, I just don't, this is not okay with what's going on right now. So yeah. Submit, you know, show up. Everyone show up. I want to ask you, because I love asking this question. When you were a kid, what did you dream of becoming?
I think that, thank you. That's a great question. I like have to process. I love what you talked about showing up. I'll say a little bit about that, then kind of get to that. When was I a kid? But I'll, you know, oftentimes, you know, when I'm talking to, particularly I work a whole lot with women or folks who identify as such, and oftentimes say become the poet laureate of your life. Like, you know, you might not ever be like a poet laureate of some city, state, region or whatever. And no, that's not interesting to you, but basically advocate for the expression of who you are and your own voice in your own life. Become your own poet laureate. Like, that's it. No one can, you know, forget all this other things. Just become your own poet laureate. Advocate for your own voice and become that for yourself. But as a kid, you know, I told people, you know, I always talk about the rurality of my life, but I would oftentimes like sit under this big oak tree growing up home. And there's this big oak tree that sat in front of our house, had this like one dog. I remember this big fat dog, Brownie, you know, who kind of like lived forever and just would never move, you know? And as a child, I think what I grew up of, when I think about it, I don't think it was ever a career. I'm gonna be honest. I never thought about, I don't want to work hard. I'm not a hard worker. It goes against my mother, who's a teacher. It goes against my family, who's all about excellence. And I went to college, got degrees. I did it. But I always just grew, I always just dreamed of imagining. Like my whole gift is like idea generations, like coming up with ideas for myself and for other people, helping people like spearhead their imagination. So I'm always, all my life is, even now, I'm always under that oak tree, imagining and dreaming. So I think as a kid, I imagined that I would be a dreamer. And I didn't see anything abnormal or wrong or shameful about that. And I still am that dreamer. Yes, we do have to, dreamers have to pay bills. You know, I'm learning that. You know, we need to have better credit. But that's what I just have to admit. Like, I just dreamed of dreaming and dreaming with other people. Yeah.
Another t-shirt idea. Dream with me.
Oh, beautiful. Hey, got it.
Yes. Thank you for that answer. I mean, it's so good to know the self, because then you know the capacities you have for what you can bring into the world. I love that we're like more than half an hour into the conversation, and I'm now asking the second question, which is, that means it's a good conversation. Okay. Did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like as a kid? And then how has that connection maybe evolved over the course of your life?
Yes, that's the thing when you talk with poets. It's like, poets don't seem like they talk that much. Yes, poets, all we do. Yeah, I did grow up in a very religious household. My family, I was a Christian. I still am. My mother, very much so. I grew up with a single mother. I have two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother. And my father, even though divorced pretty early, my very first memory is standing in front of a Sunday school class in a church in this small town called Fonsdale, Alabama, with my father, who was teaching Sunday school. You know, I remember standing at his leg as a child. You like, you hold onto your dad's leg or hold onto your parents' leg as they're teaching. It's like, okay, I'm not gonna let go. So very, very religious, but also very spiritual. And for us, church every Sunday, Sunday school before church, or every Sunday. We had something called a young people's department, youth group every week, that kind of thing. Wednesday Bible study. I am from the Bible Belt. So all the things that you might have heard, except for, you know, some of the other kind of like maybe challenging things. But for me, it was community. It was a village. And it really was about community and village. When we think about the things that are happening in our society today and where we are, I always go back to the community and the village of the church, and the community and the village that the church contended for all of us when I was growing up. So there were, of course, imperfections. Of course, there was like, okay, these are things that I necessarily are not part of my belief systems and values today. But I see that there was a community and village that people were protecting, but also making sure that we were there for each other. Like I tell people all day long, like, if anything happens in the world today, we know how to survive. And by we, my family, rural America, like, you talk about survival, come on now. You talk about food, you talk about community, like people who are close and know how to connect. The church gave me that. Yeah. But today, my role with the church is a little bit the same. I started with religion, not the church. I still have the same values of believing in a higher power, believing in God. I do have the value of I'm on assignment as a calling as a result of God for me. Of my understanding is God and Jesus Christ. That's my understanding. But I also am not tethered to a particular institution or system, much like I was growing up. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for all amazing, amazing. I just love listening to you in general. It doesn't matter what you're saying. You could probably be reading in an ingredient list for a, you know, cake box mix. And I would be like, oh my God, this is amazing. I want to just say that what you're talking about and what you're sharing really reminds me of this gorgeous Catholic icon, this beautiful painting. I once went to a lecture at University of Portland, up in Portland, Oregon. And it was someone who was an artist or basically a theologian / lecturer / researcher who had spent decades investigating beautiful images of Catholic icons of all sorts, beautiful works of art, essentially. And, you know, he was saying, what is this really saying here? What is this really saying? And there was this great one of, it looked so simple, just so simple. And I thought, I think I'm missing more than half of life just in general, but it was three people. They look like women, but they were wearing coverings at this table. And you were looking at them sitting around this table, one in the back, one on the side, another one on the other side. And, you know, he said, everybody's been trying to figure out what is this, you know, what does this mean? It's so simple, but it's clearly powerful. Why is it powerful? Why is this resonating? And he said, what a lot of people miss is that there's a fourth space and it's for you. And it's basically the invitation. There is a place for you at the table. Recognize that, understand that. And so for me, I've extrapolated that out into my life that I think a lot of, I mean, I'm going to generalize here, but the fracturing of our society, a lot of the, polarization, more people need to be invited to our tables. And that means, you know, what does that look like? Who knows what that looks like? It'll look different for every single person. But that means, you know, maybe making friends with someone who has a different point of view, and saying, hey, come over for dinner, or hey, come to this party that we're having, like include them. Because then when you include people and you ask them to share with you, whether it's your life or a meal or what have you, you can get to know each other better and maybe experience some compassion and empathy and understanding for where they're coming from. And they can experience that as well. And so I'm all for, you know, the invitation for the table, that empty space, it's always there for everyone.
That is so beautiful and such a reminder that we also have this responsibility for those of us who are like grappling with what's happening in the world today, or just grappling with our own lives, that we have an opportunity to evoke empathy and compassion and put it in action. It's like, okay, I have compassion and empathy, you know, I feel, you know, I'm, you know, but it's okay. Well, it's also, that's a verb, you know, those aren't these stationary terms that we just like, do you feel, you should feel like this about things. Like, no, it's actually putting it into action. Like you mentioned your friend who says she's just fatigued from showing up, or just privilege that, you know, hey, throw my hands up in the air. I don't have to, so I won't. And then it's like, okay, do I have a space that I can, that feels nurturing and tender, and that I can invite folks in who might feel fatigued or might feel like, you know what, I don't need to be a part of that. I think that's the answer, and probably one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, The Other Revival, and finish it and put this voice out there, is because The Other Revival is that space that there are other revivals that are happening, not just the traditional revivals that have happened in the past, but there can be the revival that you have at your table, revival that you have at your little, at your circle, you know, revival on your own front porch, you know, revival in your home, that, you know, with your family and someone's kid who maybe, you know, is struggling with questions about things. Like, we have this, what I call gentle power to be spirit led to do these things, you know. And I love that. Yeah, absolutely. And that's beauty. That's art. Yeah. A table full of people who are grappling with whatever, and we all decide to have compassion. That's art. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the word revival, because if you just, this is how my brain works. Okay. Because there is something inside that word that implies motion to me. If you say it over and over again, I get the image of a circle that is revolving, and it's probably because there's revival and then revolve is very close. And for me, the word revival, you know, once you get it started, once you invite that first person to your table, it becomes one of those machines that just keeps going because you've started it already. And so inside revival, once you start it, it will keep going. If you tend to it and just witness it, it will perpetuate itself because it is one of those energies that will just, it's meant to be brought into the world. And maybe after a while it will have a mind of its own, but that's okay. Because it will be good. It'll be a good mind. But I'll tell you a story. It was very interesting. I was in the Gulf Coast last year, house sitting for some friends, and I was doing some sightseeing, and there are all these forts down there. I thought, I love history, so I was like, I'm going to drive out and see these forts. And I haven't seen that part of the country, which is beautiful, but also a little strange at the same time. And I decided, I don't know what I was thinking, because I get so seasick, to take the ferry from one fort to another one across the bay. The car gets on, the ferry departs. All of a sudden, I realize, dear God, I'm going to puke everywhere. What was I thinking? This is horrible. So I get out of my car and I stand by the, you know, I'm like, I just got to look at the water, or look at the, you know, what's the approach? It's like a 45-minute trip. So I'm like at the railing, and this woman approaches, and, you know, she's like, makes small talk. And it was very clear that she was sussing me out. And so here I am, like, trying not to puke all over everybody. And she was like, oh, where are you from? And I said, you know, I live in New Mexico, but then I was taking care of my mom in Chicago. And she said, oh, you're from the North. And inside that was, she was white. Inside that was so much.
So much.
I felt it. Oh my God. And I thought, oh, whoa. Okay. So I kind of understand the game that has just started right now. And I thought, you know, I could suppose all these things about her just by this question, you know, what her thoughts and interior beliefs are, and her, the way she orients herself to the world. Or I could just diffuse it by pretending like I did not hear what she was implying and just have good conversation. So that's what I did, because I was like, I just cannot engage, or nor do I want to, because I'm about to puke and this could be a life change. You know, this could be a beautiful conversation. So that's what I did. I oriented us towards something that was, you know, oh, you know, how long have you lived here and what have you done and all of these things. And I made it about her, which was great, because by the time we were finished, I could go back into my car and like drive off that ferry. It was really interesting how within, what, 45 seconds of meeting, there was that question, and so much was implied in it about who I was. And I thought, I could take the bait on this. I can't do it right now, nor do I want to, because is it going to serve either one of us? No. You know, I know what she's fishing for, but I don't want to play with like that today. Let's create something different. It was actually very, very interesting. An interesting experience, because I did not expect it.
Wow. Wow. Exactly. And I love how you created something beautiful and you made a choice to do that. That is such a great, you know, great idea when I think about like the work. What is our work in the world? Like, you asked a question about poetry. I see poetry as a service, and being a poet, you know, poet laureate, but also just being a poet or being a creative or just a human being, it's this service, this greater service to all. And like, what's going to serve me in this moment where there could be this trickling of bias or this trickling of sizing up, you know, who I am and sizing up, you know, going into conversation that may not be creatively productive. But I love that. How do we create beauty in the midst of times where it could be opportunities for something ugly to happen, particularly conversations? And I bet that changed this person's whole perspective on their day. You know, they're ready to like size up something and say, okay, you know, but then it's like, no, we're not going to go there. Let's find out more about each other.
Yeah.
And especially you, you know, you tell me about you. Like, we all love that. People love to talk about themselves. When people talk about me interviewing people, like, I can't believe people let you interview. Oh, people love to be interviewed. I mean, not like it's for this TV thing, but it's like, oh my gosh, you have to ask me about myself and what I do and that kind of thing. Because you're interested. Like, I'm interested, truly interested in who you are and creating something productive in this conversation. So that's a beautiful story.
Thank you. It was a little alarming for me because I have this, I'm highly sensitive to scary situations. And so it definitely triggered me when she said that. And I thought, I need to be really careful right now. And so I wish, I just like all my alarm bells went off and I was like, okay, I can swim, but I don't want to get thrown off by the ferry by this moment. I mean, I can swim.
It's like, no, no, thank you. I'm already queasy. I don't need
You know, the other thing I think it's so important to remember, and I, you know, went like that woman on the ferry, especially women of every single kind are never given the opportunity to tell their story. They're never given a platform, even by their husbands, you know, their loved ones, their partners, their families. People aren't interested in what they have to say. People, they get shut down. So I've met so many women who have never been heard or listened to. I thought, what? I didn't know this was a, yes. Women are not given platforms, even in their own families, to express their cares, their concerns, tell their stories of their interior selves. And so also with this woman, you know, I got the feeling no one had ever really been there for her to like ask these questions and say, hey, tell me about yourself. I think it was a weird thing for her. She's like, this is weird. But I've run up against that so much just since that time, just women who there's a woman at the museum where I work and she didn't speak until she was 13. And that was because her family was so abusive and she was basically told not to speak. So even now she's in her, I would say early 70s, she wrestles with that. So I just was like, oh my God, women of every type, all over the world, I suspect, have been told to shut up and not, you know, not, you know, talk about themselves, not tell about themselves, not share. And so I really want to be one of those people that's there for them to let them
know. That is so true.
Yeah.
Yes. The whole idea of how our own voices are the agency of our voice can begin to heal our own lives. And as women who are taught to like be seen and not be heard, you know, we're taught that we are to be beautiful and taught that we are to be, you know, quiet and to be, comforting to other people and to be busy, 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 busy. We don't want to hear your voice. But I think it's very important, you know, when you have an opportunity to like be a circle for women, be a circle. And what I really hope to do is listen better. I believe that the healing is not necessarily in the poetry or the art, but the healing really is in being heard.
Yeah.
Feeling heard, feeling known. Like now I feel known. And for women, our instinct to carry on a life that no one even knows about, And we're carrying on these lives that we don't even care about. When we began to exact our voices, that's what happens. And I think for me, I started poetry after depression and after a major divorce as well. Let me just go to a writing class. Let me just do something, you know, like the therapist, go journal. And you're like, let me go find a writing class to like find an outlet. And I was not, the stigma of depression, the stigma of divorce, the stigma of being older, the stigma of being unpartnered, I don't have children, all the things, childless, blah, 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 all the things. And sitting, at this writing class with other women, sitting on this lady's red couch, I began to write myself back together again. I began to hear that my voice was poetry because other women would speak back to me and say, I think you're writing a poem. I think your voice sounds like poetry. I think that is something other people will want to hear. And not only am I voicing who I am now, but I have other women who are validating that, you know, not in a superficial way, but in a way in which allows me to know that I am seen and heard. And so that's the medicine for women, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm like, okay. I just, you're done. My nervous system just with the conversation is just feeling so good. I want you to know that. So thank you. I'd love to ask the main question of the podcast, which is, I would greatly appreciate if you could share an incident, a moment, an event in your life where you felt you witnessed something magical, miraculous, or mysterious. You know, I've had every story under the sun, as you can imagine, because humans are meaning makers. And, you know, some of the events, someone might call very prosaic, a mother that was really loving, who shaped someone's life. I have had ghost stories. I mean, I've really heard everything. It's kind of been an astonishing experiment. So I'd love to hear whatever you'd like to share.
Oh, yes. I kind of think about that. I think I've experienced magic in each stage of my life. I think magic, I just love the idea of being able to experience magic and call it magic and not to shy away from it and think it's something that's scary or something that is kind of like off-putting and all these kinds of things. It's a witchery, whatever the word is. So I get like millions of magical stories, and I'm going to think the one that's really coming up, it's kind of two, and maybe I can quickly tell them, but when I was writing this particular book, The Other Revival, and had gone through so much illness, I remember one day standing between, kind of like if you see the photo on the cover of the book, which I had no intention for it to be me on the cover of the book. I was like, no, I do not want to see myself on nothing, you know. Anyway, I was standing in front of these trees one kind of dusk night or evening at the plantation, which I said, I'm not going to this place at night. Like, I am not one of those people. I'm not going here at night. And I was there at night, and I have just like grappling with this illness, and I had to finish the work. And I looked inside of the Wallace house. Now, the Wallace house is swept clean. So it's not an antebellum home or a space that you usually tour where you see these fancy curtains and all these things. It's swept clean by meaning it's just wallpaper that's been stripped and been there for hundreds and hundreds of years and just all this thing. But anyway, I looked up into the windows of this tall white building while I'm there finishing some writing and getting inspiration. And I saw this glimpse of this lady in a yellow apron. So of course I thought that's my imagination of being here out at night. And then I looked back up and I kept seeing these glimpses of this apparition of this lady and this yellow apron as I'm there at this Wallace plantation trying to heal while finishing. And then as I looked, this lady came out of these red kind of barn doors, which the Wallace house has, these like old red crumpled up brown doors that just are so large. And now everybody wants these barn doors, right? But these barn doors, that was like this labor of this black labor. And she comes out of these barn doors down these white kind of rickety stairs or steps off of this porch. And this lady in this yellow apron, who I can tell has been the overseer of this former plantation for 300 years, walks off the plantation and leaves. And I'm still standing there watching this black, elderly apparition of a woman in a yellow apron with this beautiful, wrinkled, dark black skin and gray hair with a braid that kind of flows down the length of the apron, barefoot, walk off this plantation and leave into the fog of this dusky evening in rural Alabama. And as I stand there, I clearly hear the ending for the book. And the ending for the book was, we all have a plantation or something in our lives that we need to walk off of. What is your revival? Where will you find your revival? If an elderly Black woman who was former enslaved can leave her overseeing house and just walk off a plantation, what do you need to walk off of? So I walked off the plantation too. Book done. Done. Done, done, done. The lady in the yellow apron is my revival, and I believe she is all of our revivals.
Wow. Just want to just remark on your, I don't know. I have never seen a ghost. Okay. Knock on wood. There we go.
Get ready. Okay. No.
Yes. Yeah. Quite honestly, this whole incident you handled with such a grace, because if I was on a property like that at dusk and something like that happened to me, I would probably fall down to the ground in a fetal position and, be scared, but you handled it with such wow. That okay, was it a revelation for you?
Yes, it was. It was a holy revelation for me. Yes, 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 girl. Yes, it was a holy revelation for me and my. I mean, my whole life had, you know, yes, my whole revelation had been tethered and stuck to things that are absolutely not good for me. Absolutely, you know, even doing this work at this poetry at this Wallace House plantation. That's a now nonprofit that also is still owned by the white enslavers who just like steal part of like this industrial complex of, you know, not getting paid what I need to get. All these things was a revelation. But the biggest revelation for me was not that, not to be afraid. It was like this space of peace and where there was no fear. Like usually I'm a very like scared. I don't like horror movies. I just like, I knew not to be there at night. I'm like, okay, you know, I just don't like, and usually I would have been like you. I would have been like totally on the ground or like trying to like call someone. But in that moment, it was just a sense of peace, a sense of assignment done. Like this yellow lady in yellow apron, assignment done, completed. Salam, your revelation. Completion of this assignment to carry these voices away from the plantation. The stories of this book is to carry these voices so that their personal revivals can be heard away from the places that have broken the spirit of them. If this woman can walk off a plantation who was never supposed to walk off, does and goes and finds her own revival, my revelation was, yes, ma'am, go find yours. Or I am my own revival. She is her own revival. Kirsten, you are your own revival. We are our own revivals.
I'm so struck by this story, and one, the word that keeps coming up to me is witness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just as we spoke earlier about the land witnessing and holding what happened in that location, here you are, you've come back to witness in all these different ways. And then there's this beautiful image of her witnessing you. It's showing up for you before she leaves the plantation. It's like she showed up to say, I witness you and the work that you're doing. And there's just this incredibly circular beauty of seeing and understanding and appreciating and saying, you know, I see you. I notice you. I appreciate you. And we're all in this together.
Yes. And I felt like also she was saying, thank you. It's just a graciousness. Like, thank you for giving me permission to do the courageous thing Thank you for tilling this ground. Thank you for healing yourself enough as well so that I can now feel that, like you were saying, and move away and go find that. Yeah.
And that's it, everybody. That, alas, is the end of my conversation with Salem Green. But to be honest, I'm hoping to bring her back onto the podcast because I think that she and I have so much more to talk about, and I really want to get her voice out into the world. I am a fan of supporting and lifting other people up in whatever way I can do so, in whatever small way I can contribute, because I firmly believe that supporting other creators, other beings in the world, whatever form or shape they might take, will be the key to creating more beauty and more justice and equality for everyone. I need to thank Salem for her gracious presence, her beautiful words, her way of moving in the world. All of it was such a gift to me, and I hope a gift to you as well. There will be a link in the episode show notes to her website, but also to her revelatory book, The Other Revival, Poems and Reckonings. She changed my life. And, you know, not only was the conversation such a blessing to me, but then again, you know, I get the double pleasure of producing it and going back over our conversation and her words. And gosh, another reminder and another gift to me. So, yes, it felt like Christmas came early this year, and I am so grateful. Please be sure to click on those links to support this groundbreaking and enchanting and gorgeous creator. And please do remember, I live and thrive on ratings and reviews. So whatever platform you listen to this podcast on, please do consider leaving a rating or writing a little review. I'm so very grateful to those of you who take the time. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Salem. And you know, there are a lot of things I could say about her. Show up to your life. Be generous of spirit. Include everyone. Step forward to the challenge. I mean, the list was very long when I had to pick how you could be like Salem. It was so long. But then I settled with this. And I've said it before. Accept the invitation. Life is giving you invitations all the time to show up more profoundly and with more capacity than you've ever had before each and every day. You never know when those invitations are going to come. And Salem calls them appointments. But whatever language you use, they are being offered to you. And I love Salem and just her utter humanness when she said, I applied to be poet laureate in the last 10 minutes, because sometimes we show up for our invitations right before the finish line. And that doesn't mean that we're going to fail. It might mean that we showed up right on time. So be like Salem and show up for your appointments. Accept your invitations, because you never know. Oh my gosh, you never know what kind of magic and what kind of just amazingness is waiting out there for you to walk hand in hand with it.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm going to carry this conversation with me for the rest of the day. I just want you to know, probably the rest of the week, maybe the month. Yes. We'll see.
Likewise. Yeah. Yes.
Now you said you might want to tell a second story, so I didn't want to cut you off if you do want to share that story as well.
Well, just quickly, this, whenever I think about this lady in this yellow apron, she just reminds me of my grandmother who lived in rural Alabama, to this small town called Snow Hill, Alabama. And my grandmother, who never worked, never learned how to drive, you know, all the things. But also, I always just have this memory of my grandmother walking on her own land. You know, land that, you know, she owned, collard greens that she planted. There was a smokehouse where there was meat, where she smoked meat, ham, and, you know, pigs. And, you know, I'm from Alabama, you know, all of that, chickens on her. And so when I think, and it's the dichotomy, when I think of that lady in yellow apron, I think of my grandmother walking in her own revivals every day, gardening, you know, on her front porch, making, you know, homemade meat, all these things, you know, which is not as prolific, I guess, as the lady in yellow apron, or, but it's like, isn't that all our grandmothers? And we think about if they survived and made their own little small revivals every day, not these big things I know I've been trying to do in my life, but it's like, wake up and walk to the garden and pick your collard greens and then walk back into your house, you know, like my grandmother did on her own land, proud and satisfied. Yeah.
Okay.
Our grandmothers are magic. Yeah, she's magic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and what a huge gift and a blessing to know her in that way and see her in that way. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know my grandparents. So I love hearing about other people's grandparents because I can in that way sort of understand who they can be in our lives or how they can be present in our lives. And that gives me a lot of comfort because that kind of, I don't know, those people in our lives model for us a way of being in the world. You know, there's a potential there for us to witness them and say, oh, this is a possibility for me too, to just be present in our lives, to appreciate the small things, the large things, and to understand that our lives, you know, whatever our lives look like, can be made of beauty and appreciation for all that's around us. So it sounds like what you're, you know, just a part of who your grandmother was. So thank you. Okay. I want to ask you, and this is not, would you like to share one of your poems on the show?
Sure. That's what I was kind of looking for. I would love to do that. absolutely. I would maybe share one from the section about the lady in the yellow apron to see what does she have to say to us today. I'll read a poem about the woman in the yellow apron as medicine. I think she is most definitely medicine in my medicine. So the name of the title of the poem is The Woman in the Yellow Apron is Medicine from the Other Revival. And the thing I'll say about my grandmother, her mother was enslaved. So my great grandmother was born in enslavement. And when we think about like how many generations ago this life of world was, you know, we think, oh, no, that's, you know, 90,000 years ago. When I think of my grandmother, I remember as she walked proudly that she knew her mother when her mother was 6 or 7 or 8 years old, was still living on someone else's unfree, still living unfree. And my grandmother lived free. And when I speak about that, I'm not speaking of my great, 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 great. I'm speaking of 2 generations, 3 generations ago. And my grandmother, I knew very well who her mother was, the lady in the yellow apron. So this poem quickly, the woman in the yellow apron is medicine. The medicine mother is a balm to the land, overseer of acres for generations. mother ancestor can predict rain from clouds hovering. She says when the cows lay down, tucking tails between their legs, a storm is brewing. Then she takes out her silver tinctures and collects rain, water, and drops to treat the people who cry. She transforms this house into a hospice for those who worked while gales tore through. The tinctures line the back porches of the Wallace house, awaiting the men folks to come for their healing. Touch is her medicine. The men with oil on their foreheads rest underneath oak and mulberry trees next to the children's buried pottery. The woods will come alive again. The animals will roar, and there will be awakening. There will be no unmerciful masters. There will be the woman in the yellow apron as medicine, a balm to this land. A touch of her medicine will change and transform all that await healing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kirsten. This is a beautiful podcast, and thank you for bringing beauty and also this healing circle of two people together. That's going to be a revival for other people in the world. So thank you.
Oh my gosh. You're what a gift for me today.